Welcome to the podcast series from the 8th Educational Seminar on Migration 2021 entitled, Migration in a Multilateral World, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You are listening to the panel discussion on how to foster legal avenues for migrants and refugees to the EU, moderated by Zuzana Vatralova, Head of International Organization for Migration Slovakia. Guest speakers of the panel discussion are Tessel J. DeLange, Professor of European Migration Law and Director of the Center for Migration Law, Amir Chomer, Project Coordinator in Triple Win, Marina Brizer, Director of the Talent Beyond Boundaries, and Kate Hooper, Policy Analyst in Migration Policy Institute. Enjoy the listening.
Dear participants, welcome to the last part of our summer educational seminar here in Bratislava. We are going to talk about how to foster legal avenues for migrants and refugees to the European Union. As we've heard, demand for labor force is enormous globally. For example, only in the European Union, 25% of the workers in the personal care and food preparation sectors are non-EU born. So we also heard during our educational seminar that restrictions do not work, like Professor Weiss, for example, said. Only make the journey more dangerous. We've also heard that we need to foster legal pathways. So the question is not whether, but how to make it a successful experience. Today we have very distinguished guests here at our panel as a finale of this year's seminar. Following our presentations on development, remittances and waitinghood today, we are going to discuss, like I said, labor migration. And we will start with an overview of the current legal pathways for migrants into the European Union. We will introduce two new concepts and initiatives, Triple Win and Talent Mobility, and we will conclude with lessons learned from the new initiatives. I am really honored to be joined by my experts here, Ms. Tessel J. DeLange, good afternoon, Mr. Amir Chomer, good afternoon, Amir, Ms. Marina Brizer, and Ms. Kate Hooper. Like I said, we will start with an overview of what is already in place, what is working, what might not be working. And we will start with Ms. Tessel J. DeLange. She's originally a lawyer, a professor of European Migration Law and director of Center of Migration Law, both at Radboud University in the Netherlands. Professor DeLange is also international expert on migration with a research focus on economic migration and migrants' socioeconomic rights. As always, you have the full bio of our experts in your documents. So, Ms. DeLange, what are the current legal pathways to the European Union, if you may start this panel? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction and for the opportunity to join you. I've prepared a slide presentation, so maybe now is the time to start that on the screen. Yes, thank you very much. So I've been asked to really, in a nutshell, speed talk you through the legal pathways that we have in place right now. And for those of you, and I know that this material will be shared, are interested, I just before summer, I did my inaugural lecture at Radboud University on what I call the welcoming of talent. And some of the ideas that I will discuss today are discussed there, more elaborate. So I invite anybody interested to watch the lecture online. But for now, a brief version. So let's take it to the next slide. Yeah, what I present to you here are four avatars who star in the migration game, a game that we are developing for students, policymakers, and others involved in trying to figure out how all these legal pathways fit together and what rights come with what pathway. Very briefly, Pavel, intra-EU mobility as an EU citizen and possibly also for third country nationals who come through the instrument of posting. I will not address the intra-EU mobility of EU citizens further, but it is mentioned before and it is a very relevant factor of labor migration in the EU. Then the third country nationals who come through legal migration channels. I will discuss him more in depth in a moment. But first, Rima. Rima stands for asylum-based migration into the EU. I've listed the relevant directives there and instruments that also deal with the resettlement of refugees from places where they are as displaced persons, usually. Just to mention, the new Pact on Migration and Asylum offers some interesting ideas on how refugees and those receiving subsidiary protection in the EU can access our labor market through fast-tracking especially highly skilled refugees into intra-EU mobility for work purposes. We'll have to see whether that actually comes about. So this is not something that we already have. It is something that we are working on, so to say. And these are typical three EU-regulated legal pathways, and I will look into Mike's situation more closely. But DEVI stands for the national policies, because EU migration law leaves a lot of room for national alternatives. And you see that member states compete among each other or try to avoid applying EU law through their national law. And there's quite some room to maneuver under national law. But focusing on legal migration based on EU migration law for now, next slide, please. I want to talk about this patchwork of legal migration directives. From 2003 up to, next month probably, seven directives on legal migration into the EU have been agreed on family reunification, on students, researchers, trainees, and that is a relatively recent directive, but it is a recast of two previous directives, specifically on students and one on researchers. Then there's the blue card directive and a recast, which hopefully next month the European Parliament will vote on in a positive way so that the implementation process can take a start. There's a directive on intra-corporate transferees. So it's a very specific setting of multinationals transferring their specialist managers and trainees across the globe that is facilitated in that directive. There's one on seasonal workers, which is tied, the title says it, to work that is dependent on the passing of the seasons. And, that is not defined further, but you can imagine that that's typically something that is open for debate, what kind of work actually fits the passing of the seasons. A lot of agricultural work does, but then reasoning from at least the Dutch perspective, a lot of agricultural work is done in glass houses and the seasons don't really matter. Definitions, but it is for seasonal workers. It's also the only one that we actually have on practical skilled migration. The others all deal with highly qualified people. Two more to mention. The single permit directive actually doesn't have anything on admission, but it sets the conditions for procedures. How do we design just procedures? And it gives a set of rights, equal treatment rights to those who are entering the EU for work purposes or for other purposes, but who are working. And finally, there's a long-term residence directive, which is not relevant for first entry into the EU, but it is a status that can be obtained after 5 years in the EU and does facilitate limited level of intra-EU mobility. I will come back to some of the details of these directives, but I just wanted to introduce them to you. For further reading, Center of Migration Law regularly publishes these little booklets on these directives, and these are all available online. So if you want to read up more on one specific directive, please feel free to consult these booklets. We can go to the next slide, please. So how do these directives work in practice? That was the question also in the introduction placed. Well, looking at the numbers, these are public, the member states have to deliver numbers on their effect, and not all member states do, and they don't do in time, so this data is not really very complete. And there's a very interesting one. I didn't add it in the slides. You can look it up on the paper that I refer to on this slide. It's a paper I did with Professor Groenendijk on this patchwork. And we included a graph of the number of single permits granted. So this is the residence permit that really everybody gets who comes to work in the EU from outside the EU. Slovakia in 2019 granted more than 25,000 of these permits. Poland, 93,000, which is actually a lot of seasonal workers from the Ukraine under the Seasonal Workers Directive. The Netherlands, who's very keen on presenting itself as a country that is like a forerunner of the highly skilled migration into the EU, only has 2,500. Now, that is not correct. These numbers show that there's a difference in interpretation of what is a single permit, who gets a single permit, yes or no. And it is something that at the local market, with local lawyers, I've said, you guys, make a case out of this, go to court. And then they say, oh, go to court. That takes too much time, and business doesn't have time to take cases to court. This graph that you do see on the slide is a presentation of the number of cases that actually went to the European Court of Justice with questions on this legal pathway directives. And as you can see, most of the questions are on family reunification and long-term residence, and there is very little questions raised on the economic migration directives. And for one reason, that is because business does not have time, 2, 3, 4 years, to get an answer from a court. If they need workers, they need them now. And if it doesn't go through channel A, they'll try through channel B, but will not necessarily challenge that obstacle in this channel A, so to say. The next slide, please. So if we, next, yeah, thank you. If we look at what can be in these labor migration policies, I've drawn a little pyramid, or, well, it turned out bigger than I intended, of legislative choices that can be made when drafting migration policy. And these are all in the legal migration directives, one way or another. So there's always admission criteria, questions about skills, income levels, sectors, contract durations, country of origins, the duration of stay is, I think, a very important one, whether that's permanent or temporary. The projects that we will be talking about, I think, but correct me if I'm wrong, it's often about temporary labor migration. And I always have a fear, but then maybe that's because I'm getting old, that this will be the new guest worker programs all over again. So please convince me that I'm wrong and don't need to fear that this insecurity of stay will have negative consequences on society as a whole, at least for some period. Of course, things are moving forward. It always does, but duration of stay is, I think, an important element to legislate. Equal treatment rights, I mentioned, single permit directive, of course, sets these, but the intra-corporate transferee directive said something else. It said we treat them as posted workers, which is a little less than equal treatment with nationals. The procedures that apply in a country are very important. If an application takes 6 months, that's definitely a barrier to legal migration pathways. And people might say, we're not going to wait, we're going to do it in a different way. And that might not be a regular way. So having strong, clear, fast procedures in place is very important. The rights, not only equal treatment rights, but also right to family reunification is important. Seasonal workers don't have a right to family reunification. Students don't have a right, while the blue card and the ICT do. And they actually get all sorts of benefits for their family members in contrast to, for instance, the seasonal workers. So you see how this is like a little catalog. I can talk about it for hours. I will not do that. It's a little catalog of what legislative choices to be made when looking into legal migration pathways. And I guess, Natalia, looking at the time, I will leave it at that for now and look forward to the discussion with the other members of the panel.
Thank you very much, Professor De Lange, for this opening of the panel and opening of the topic for us. And as promised, we do have two examples of initiatives or projects that are innovative, that are new, that are developed by young people, I dare to say, and that are worth considering for following, I think. We have touched upon impact of labor migration on countries of origin during our educational seminar, and we heard that, quote, your need is our talent loss. Or we also heard, South supplies skills to the North, end of quotation. So let me introduce you the new project or new initiative, one of the two that we are talking about today, the Triple Win. The aim of the Triple Win is to ensure sustainable recruitment of nurses from outside of European Union to the EU, mainly to Germany. Like I said, we have Mr. Emir Čomor among us. He has been acting as a project coordinator of the Triple Win in Bosnia and Herzegovina since 2018. And the project focuses sustainable recruitment of nurses to Germany, like I said, from Bosnia and Herzegovina, Philippines, and Tunisia. In the past, Emir worked as a coordinator of Goethe Institute in Bosnia and Herzegovina, based in Sarajevo. So, Emir, could you please tell us more about the project?
Yes, of course. First, I would like to greet you all warmly from Sarajevo, and I hope you enjoyed the last 2 days and also today, of course. I will start with a short video, promo video of the project Triple Win, and then afterwards I will show you a short presentation about the project Triple Win. So I would like to start with the video of the project Triple Win. Sorry, this is the presentation. I would like first to start with the video.
Demographic trends in Germany and the European Union are leading to a growing shortage of nurses and care workers for the elderly. With the number of patients requiring care on the rise, Germany's hospitals and nursing homes already lack a sufficient number of well-qualified staff. By contrast, other countries outside the EU have a surplus of healthcare professionals. Triple Win offers German employers a way to solve this problem. It recruits skilled workers fairly from third countries. Currently, the Philippines, Serbia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Die Länder, in denen wir rekrutieren, haben in jedem Fall einen Überhang an Fachkräften, sodass dort kein Mangel entsteht. Wir haben auf der anderen Seite die Arbeitgeber im Blick, die vorbereitete Fachkräfte bekommen. Und wir haben für die Fachkräfte eben einfach einen sicheren Kanal. Sie sind gut vorbereitet. Und sie bekommen eben auch die gleichen Konditionen wie deutsche Fachkräfte, wenn sie hier anfangen zu arbeiten.
An established process is used to select project participants through a transparent application procedure, advise the care institutions on employing skilled workers from third countries, prepare the workers for their employment assignment in Germany, and subsequently assist them with integrating into German society. Triple Win is conducted in partnership with the workers' home countries. Project staff maintain contact with the cooperation partners locally.
Wir sind seit einer Woche hier in Serbien und haben in verschiedenen Städten unterschiedliche Kandidaten kennengelernt, die in Deutschland als Gesundheits- und Krankenpfleger arbeiten möchten.
The German Federal Employment Agency's International Placement Services Department conducts selection interviews locally in the workers' home countries. The process of making the workers feel welcome begins in their home countries, where we address bureaucratic hurdles by helping them to apply to have their qualifications recognized in Germany and to obtain a visa. Participants who are selected attend German classes to get their language skills up to level B1. They also undertake several days of professional training and orientation to prepare them for everyday life as healthcare professionals in Germany. The Serbian, Bosnian, and Philippine professionals arrive at their jobs in German nursing homes and hospitals with good basic German language skills and an initial idea of how the German healthcare system works. An integration workshop also prepares staff at the nursing home or hospital in order to support the preparation and social integration of the healthcare professionals.
Am Anfang für mich war sehr schwierig hier in Deutschland, aber jetzt nach dem fast ein Jahr, ich kann jetzt alles allein machen. In Deutschland habe ich einfach eine gute Zukunft für meine Kinder und meine Familie. Ich habe mit TripleWin eine große Möglichkeit bekommen. Ich wollte schon dieses Jahr mit einer Weiterbildung oder Fortbildung anfangen.
Ich bin schon seit einem Jahr hier in Deutschland. Ich habe die Anerkennungsprüfung geschafft und kann hier als examinierte Gesundheits- und Krankenpflegerin arbeiten. Als nächstes möchte ich mich im Bereich Kardiologie spezialisieren und natürlich auch noch Hessisch lernen, weil meistens von meinen Patienten sprechen Hessisch.
Der Vorteil in der Zusammenarbeit mit TripleWin ist das fachliche Know-how, das hier uns angeboten wird, und auch die Fairness. Also wir haben zusammen, oder die Vorgaben von TripleWin sind so, dass es auch für die Mitarbeiter, die wir hier gewinnen, faire Bedingungen sind und sie auf alle Fälle gut vorbereitet sind und nicht einfach nur ins kalte Wasser hier in Deutschland geschmissen werden.
Wir als Krankenhaus Nordwest sind von Anfang an am Pilotprojekt TripleWin beteiligt und sind auch froh, dass wir damals mitgemacht haben, und wir haben insgesamt 35 bis 40 Pflegefachkräfte über TripleWin angeworben. Wir sind stolz darauf, dass es uns gelungen ist, in dem Projekt die angeworbenen Mitarbeiter zu integrieren und es auch geschafft zu haben, dass sie bei uns bleiben wollen.
Thank you very much for the video. This was a short video about Project TripleWin. Unfortunately, this video is from 2015. There were some changes since 2015 related to our partner countries. During my presentation, you will see the changes regarding the partner countries. So I would like to start with my short presentation. Thank you very much. As you see on the slide one, TripleWin are strong partners. To implement a project like TripleWin, you need to have a cooperation between strong partners. As you can see, the project TripleWin is based on the cooperation between the Federal Employment Agency BA in Germany and also the GIZ in Germany since 2013. It's also important to establish a cooperation between the institutions in the partner countries. Therefore, TripleWin is based on the bilateral recruiting agreement between BA and the labor authorities of the partner countries. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, this is the ARZ, Agency for the Employment of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Our philosophy is sustainable, legal, and fair migration. Also expertise around the globe, which is something unique in the project TripleWin, and also established local structures and cooperation with local authorities. The base of the project is recruiting on behalf of German employers, who pay a GIZ service fee for coordination, language technical and intercultural training, and also integration support in Germany. Can you please go to slide? Next slide, thank you. Triple win means benefit for all parties or three winners. They are, of course, the country of origin, the German side or German employer, and also the nurses, of course. Country of origin relieving the domestic labor market by reducing the number of unemployed nurses in their home country, gaining knowledge and skills, reducing poverty through remittances of the nurses and their families. Here is, I think, the most important thing that we have the cooperation only with the countries with surplus of healthcare workers, like in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Philippines, Tunisia, and Serbia till 2020. For the German side, the benefits are skill immigration contributes to reducing of staff shortage and increase of productivity in specific healthcare sector. Also, one important fact here is the benefit for the German employers, of course. And at the end, the nurses, the benefit for the nurses are individual development and acquisition of skills, access to new employment opportunities, financial gain and risk protection, and also staying perspective in Germany. Here, I would say that the most important thing is the legal immigration to Germany as an employee for the nurses. Now you can see the changes from the video that I show you before. As you can see, we have now, there are now three partner countries in the project, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Philippines, other countries, as I told you before, and as you could see in the video. Also the interests of the country of origin. We research and analyze the interests of our partner countries. Also, we pay attention to the list of World Health Organization, and we stand for legal way of migration or employment in Germany. For the German side, there's a demand for healthcare workers, a strategy for securing skilled labor workers, and for Germany, the most important thing is to fill the gap for the healthcare workers in Germany. Yes, here are some facts and figures from the program Triple Win for you. As you can see, as you know, the project is since 2013 in three countries, more than 4,700. Placements from Triple Win partner countries since we had more than 4,700 placements from the Triple Win partner countries since 2013. Among those, there are 859 placements from Bosnia and Herzegovina. As you can see, the number isn't high because we pay attention for the brain drain, and we are also focused just for the unemployment nurses from Bosnia and Herzegovina. 689 nurses of the recruited Bosnia and Herzegovina nurses are in Germany. The rest of them is still in the country and wait for their visa or B1 certificate in Goethe Institute. And at the end, one information we have about 300 employers in Germany, so our nurses can choose where they want to go to live and to work in Germany. That's all from my side. I think I'm good in time. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So this was an example of legal pathways for specific occupation for nurses, for specialists in certain field. And we will continue discussing legal pathways, talking about forced migrants and about refugees. So let me welcome again Ms. Marina Brizar. She currently holds the position of UK Director at Talent Beyond Boundaries, rolling out displacement talent mobility in the UK. She is an Australian-trained immigration lawyer. Again, we have a lawyer here, and has been recognized by numerous professional awards. She has very interesting CV, so I encourage you to read it, the whole and the full bio. And we are connected, if I'm not mistaken, to London, Marina, isn't it?
That's right. It feels a little bit like Eurovision, London calling, but yes, calling in from London. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you. It's great to be here, great to be among such esteemed colleagues, and really great to be part of this final session, which really builds on the theme of safe routes, legal routes, and opportunities for people to move, because essentially, that's all people want to do, have the freedom to make that choice. So before I launch into my presentation on the screen, if I could please have the video play.
I have a master's degree in financial engineering from the Lebanese University in Tripoli, Lebanon. I am fluent in three languages, Arabic, French, and English.
I graduated in 2008 from Damascus University as a software engineer.
And then I continued my master, but unfortunately I couldn't continue it because of war.
As a Syrian living in Lebanon, it's really very hard. You don't have a residence permit. You can't work legally.
Most people will dream of owning a car or a house or becoming married or fathering children someday. Over the course of the last 25 years, I've kind of trained myself not to dream and not to have these high expectations.
We're always facing hiring challenges.
We have a high benchmark for the people that we want to bring into IRIS.
Hiring is very challenging for us. The competition for talent is intense. We often require quite specialised skill sets which are restricted in the market.
I guess what we were hoping for was to resolve our labour shortage, but also contribute to that humanitarian aspect as well.
We're in a necessity to find pockets of unidentified talent that we can get access to.
And you're likely to find those, as we did, through Talent Beyond Boundaries.
Honestly, Talent Beyond Boundaries stood by me all the way through it.
On 23-2019, I got my visa.
When I told my wife, she told me, you're just kidding me.
I can't describe the feeling because it's really very emotional to describe it. You can't, there are no words.
The minute I set foot on that plane, I actually dared to start dreaming again.
It was a turning point in my life. It was like a party.
TBB had done a selection process and provided us with a pool of high quality candidates.
The best things that have come out of employing Ali is really achieving a skilled employee who's come to us already very competent.
The process that is supported by Talent Beyond Boundaries makes it easy. They normalise recruitment of high quality talent wherever it is so that it is the same as hiring domestically.
It's critical for Australia's ongoing competitiveness for us to not just look within our local pool, to lift our eyes up and identify talented people living elsewhere and under constraints.
There is a lot of talented people. They are not just talented, they need to start a new life.
Either they are doctors, nurses, engineers. Most of them are graduated people and they are living as refugees. They have skills. They really have skills.
What I'd say to other employers, it's really no more difficult than employing someone locally.
Now I can actually think for the future. I can establish a career. I actually have goals for the next 2 and 3 years, and I never had that in my life.
I started learning piano. I started learning video editing. It's changed totally.
I felt I had a purpose now. I had a purpose other than just surviving.
I'm working in awesome company. I'm living in beautiful city. All my career has changed. I started to build new one.
I am extremely lucky to be here today. Not everyone gets this chance. And honestly, there should be more NGOs like TBB and more employers who are willing to offer people like me a chance to be human.
So I'll give everyone a moment to maybe get some tissues, because that video gets me every time. And ironically, it's when Tarek starts laughing when he talks about video editing that I break. Anyway, if we can start the presentation, please. So, yes. Talent Beyond Boundaries exists to connect skilled refugees and forcibly displaced people with employers around the world. And to pick up on some of the themes around it's not been called brain drain, but to call it brain drain, one of the things to highlight from the talent pool that we work with is that we have a presence in Lebanon and Jordan as our source countries, and their Syrians and most Palestinians do not have the right to work. So they do not have work permits, which means that they work illegally, even though they are skilled. So what that means is in Jordan, for example, you can get a work permit for the dangerous and dirty jobs, so lots of agriculture, manufacturing, cleaning, etc. And so what we found is that we will have healthcare professionals who have a work permit to be a cleaner in a hospital, but in fact they're working as a doctor or a nurse, but being paid as a cleaner. They're not allowed to have a bank account, so they're paid in cash, if at all. And so this idea of taking talent, you know, our gain is your loss type situation, can't really be equated with this program, because these people aren't sort of captured in the local labour market. So just three points to highlight in terms of life in displacement. So again, we typically work with refugees, people seeking asylum, and those who are forcibly displaced from their country. And what we have noticed and what is becoming even more evident is that the lives in displacement are incredibly difficult. For example, in Lebanon, you have 70% of refugees who are living below the poverty line, 55% are below the extreme poverty line, and these are people with degrees and can speak multiple languages. The impact of coronavirus, the Beirut explosion, and now the financial collapse is just making the situation so much more dire. So one of the criticisms, that sort of the blanket criticism that comes up, it's like, well, if someone's got a degree and can speak English, they should just get a visa. And the problem is they can't, and that's why we exist. So, you know, bridging onto that is this idea of the lack of access to work rights, because there is no standardized process for people to be able to seek work rights in the country of asylum. And that, of course, leads to uncertain futures in terms of families, careers, skills dwindling, and so on. So that's why we exist. And if we can go to the next slide. As I say, our vision is that forcibly displaced people can use their skills to move to secure futures. Now, a little bit like Amir was talking about, we really exist to understand the barriers, to overcome them. And Talent Beyond Boundaries as an organisation really wants to pave the way for this idea of displaced talent mobility, so that it can be replicated by recruiters, by employers, by refugee-serving organisations, and for TBB not to be the only programmatic implementer of this work. So our whole aim is to open this up as a pathway to make skilled migration equitable for displaced people, and to let it run its course and to scale. A lot of our sort of power in terms of being able to make this happen is the idea that we know where the skills are and who these people are. So back in 2016, when TBB was formed, we received a grant from the US State Department under Barack Obama's administration to scope what it means to ask and answer the question of, are there skilled people in displacement? The answer was unequivocally yes. And the way that we did that was to create a technology, which we now call the Talent Catalog, which is like a LinkedIn for displaced people. Candidates go on their mobile phones or on a computer, they enter their details, it creates a file for them, it creates a CV for them, and we then search the Talent Catalog to match candidates with employment opportunities. So this was last done in September. We now have over 30,000 people registered to the Talent Catalog, representing 155 occupations. So everything from butchers and bakers to archaeologists to management consultants and, surgeons and doctors. So really, this is a huge spread of talent. And what we always say to employers is, like, be as niche as you can, because we accept the challenge and we're confident that we're able to place our candidates. What's really interesting and I'd like to highlight here is that the median age of candidates on our talent catalogue is 29. We have a representation now of about 20% of women, and we're having concerted efforts to increase that. What we found often is that females typically do not register independently on the talent catalogue if they have a spouse who has an occupation. And we had a really interesting scenario where we had a gentleman who was an engineer and his wife happened to have a master's in business administration. And once we found that out, she was put on the talent catalogue. She, in fact, got a job and is moving to the UK. In the meantime, we've also managed to find some opportunities for her engineering husband. So we're actively trying to seek that balance, and when we present candidates to employers, we make sure that there is a gender balance where possible. The really important thing to say at this point is that our program is employer-led. That means that from a destination side, so for me in the UK, I get the demand from the employers to understand what skill shortages they have. Based on that, we go to the talent catalogue to find the best candidates. What we have to have is a remote competitive recruitment process, because the candidates end up getting a skilled visa. And the worst case scenario is that the employment fit is incorrect and that the candidate will have to look at options like seeking asylum in order to remain in the country. So it is really about a competitive skilled recruitment process. What we say is our work is not charity. If you want charity, you can give a donation to a refugee organisation. This really is a business decision, a skills-driven decision that has a humanitarian outcome. And so to pick up on the title of the previous presentation and project name, it is a win-win-win. So, and we make sure that employers are very clear about that. So we basically simplified our process into 10 steps. So you have, from a destination side, the corporate outreach to understand where the skills demand and shortages are. You then have the candidate outreach from the source sides, so that's Lebanon and Jordan. Once we know what the position is we're filling, we identify candidates and we intake them to ensure that they are forcibly displaced people. So we have eligibility criteria that needs to be met through an interview. We then help the candidates refine their CVs. We submit them to the employers. The employer then makes a shortlist of who they'd like to take through interviews. We coordinate those interviews and help the candidates with interview skills, mock interviews, confidence with English language, for example. If they are successful in interview, they are given the job offer. We then do an informed decision-making session, which basically is to say, this is where you're living, this is what the salary is, this is how much, you know, the price of bread and milk is, and just to give the candidate every opportunity to understand what they're signing up for. So apart from the initial adrenaline and excitement that there is a ticket out of displacement, has to be the right fit. And we've actually had candidates who have refused offers for a number of reasons. Once they found out, you know, how long it takes to permanent residence, or they didn't want to live in a particular town, or they would prefer to be in another country where they have family and contacts. So informed decision making and this sense of empowering candidates to take hold of their own futures is really important. We then work with partners to help with visa preparation and lodgement. As that's happening, we help with settlement planning. So working with employers to see what and if they would like to be part of that program. So anything from temporary housing to mental health support, companionship and buddies, professional development, etc. So we develop a plan with employers and with other partners, including community-led groups, refugee organisations, to really give the candidate a welcome into the country. We then plan their travel and their actual physical relocation from A to B. We're there to meet them at the airport and give them the orientation, and then finally help with the post-placement integration, but also monitoring and evaluation through the entire program. So that is a simple way of putting what we do. But basically what we, the reason we've separated this into modules is because we can definitely work with partners to take the modules to break them apart so that different partners can do different parts of this process. If we take, for example, Module 6, the visa preparation and lodgement, we work with Fragerman, which is an international law firm who do a lot of our immigration work. So even though that's part of the entire stream of displaced talent mobility, different partners take on different things, and that for us is the ideal scenario for this to be fully self-sustainable and for TBB UK in particular not to exist. So if we can go to the next slide. So the opportunity here is huge, and we have been around for a while, but we're still technically in pilot phase. So in Australia, there is a pilot of 100 primary applicants over the next year into Australia. In Canada, there is a two-year pilot program for 500 primary applicants. In the UK, we have a primary program of 100 places, but then we're working with healthcare. And in fact, in 2 weeks, we're welcoming 35 nurses into the UK from Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq. So the opportunity is huge. The caliber of employers we work with is huge. We spread all industries. We work with one-on-one employers for one-on-one recruitments to working with the NHS, where we're working, the National Health Service, where we're bringing at least 200 nurses plus their families over the next 2 years. So the opportunity, the demand is definitely there. The impact is at the moment, so I drafted this 2 weeks ago. That number has now increased from 266 refugees to 306. We have the salary range, the quality of life that is best described in the video, and then the flow-on effects of remittances, which has been discussed. So this is our vision. We unlock and refine, which is where we're at now, in the sense that we develop the pathway, we see where the obstacles are, we overcome them, we develop visa pathways, etc. We then grow and graft, so bring on different partners, we grow the program, we hand it over to partners, and ultimately we want candidates to be able to access this themselves. So that, I think, is the final slide, but maybe we can go to the next slide. And yeah, that's a thank you. So that's it for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Marina. This was indeed very interesting. And if I count quickly correctly, among the two of you, Amir and you, you've had already thousands of people helped to get to country of final destination, settle down, have decent job and have security, and having had legal pathways. So now I turn to Ms. Kate Hooper, a policy analyst with MPI's International Program. She is primarily working on the Transatlantic Council on Migration, and her research areas include labor migration, migration and development, refugee and immigrant integration policies, with a focus on Europe and North America. So, Kate, what are the lessons learned and what are recommendations for legal migration pilot projects?
Thank you for the very interesting presentations. I've been taking notes and listening in throughout our discussion. So I will talk a bit about really how to recruit people for jobs or training opportunities and the role for pilot projects in this. So really building on today's conversations about how to expand legal pathways to Europe. So picking up one point that has come up in a couple of the presentations today, you know, I think it's really important to note that Europe's immigration policies are generally demand-driven. So as Maureen was saying, you know, employer offers are a really important component of that. This means that typically a third country national will need a job offer in order to be eligible to immigrate through an economic immigration channel. There are obviously some small exceptions to this, but this is generally a pretty important aspect of this as well. So when we're thinking about how to expand legal pathways, one option, therefore, is to try and encourage the use of these existing channels by employers and prospective migrants. So there are a number of different ways you can do this. One is simply to provide information to employers. For example, raising awareness among employers of opportunities to recruit internationally and providing them with information on how to do this. You know, often employers are just unaware of the immigration opportunities in place or what that procedure looks like or how much it costs, that kind of thing. So big multinationals tend to have lots of experience in this area because their operations allow them to recruit across borders. But small and medium-sized enterprises often a bit less experienced. So that's one type of way in which you can try and encourage the use of these channels. Another option is expanding recruitment networks. So connecting employers who might have these job openings with candidates in other countries they might not otherwise meet. So we've just heard about how TVB is doing this for refugees. And we've also heard about how Triple Win is doing this for, you know, German employers who are looking for nurses and connecting them with networks in other countries as well. Another example of this, even if you don't have a particular country in mind, is to, for example, create a jobs board where employers can post openings that can be reviewed by candidates in other countries and, you know, list roles that are available. Another sort of set of interventions here are thinking about some of the barriers to use and how to address these. There are lots of obstacles that can put employers off using these channels, or in turn can deter prospective migrants from, you know, applying for these jobs or trying to sort of go through this process. And there are a few different interventions that governments can think about as well. So things like speeding up processing times, introducing fast tracks for certain sectors or roles. You know, a common complaint is that international recruitment can take several months. When you factor in, you know, requirements to advertise the job, screen and select candidates, processing work permits and visas, and then also travel and the sort of supports needed once someone arrives. And so that can be a quite a long process, but there are ways in which governments can, you know, look at that process and try and streamline it a bit so it's a bit faster and also a bit more predictable for employers and, you know, people moving through these channels as well. Another type of barrier that's quite important to think about here is how to help translate foreign qualifications and experiences for employers. So it's a bit easier for local employers in destination countries to really understand how the experiences of someone who was trained or worked in a different country, you know, can really contribute to their workforce and, you know, what skills they bring to the role. So those are some types of interventions that, you know, can help improve access to existing channels, even outside of a pilot project. But in other cases, you know, I think that targeted mobility schemes or pilot projects can be really helpful. You know, this is where we see governments or other actors really playing a more proactive role in trying to expand legal migration pathways with particular countries or targeting particular categories of people with, you know, specific skill sets. So to take a step back and think about some of these targeted mobility schemes, and I'm going to be talking very general terms here. You know, we've heard about the Triple Win project as one example of this. But I think if we're defining them in the broadest sense possible, they're projects that try to facilitate mobility for work or training from one country to another. And they often focus on particular sectors like healthcare, engineering, ICT, agriculture, that kind of thing. And they have lots of goals here. You know, one is obviously to try and address labor market needs in destination countries and to provide employers with the tools to successfully recruit people from third countries. Another goal, which is very important, is providing legal migration opportunities for people in third countries who are currently unemployed. You know, there are lots of associated development benefits with migration. So things like higher wages that can lead to remittances sent back to households, opportunities to develop new skills, and the ability to apply these skills if people end up returning home at the end of their job. There's also an avenue for testing new approaches for recruiting people. So you might want to test demand by working with countries where there is less of an established migration route. There's an opportunity to build capacity for international recruitment by, say, working with labor authorities in third countries and really building up their ability to both test their local labor markets, but also gain experience of moving through these immigration processes. And there are also ways to experiment with, you know, avenues to try and promote better outcomes for migrants and countries of origins. So that might be things like supports to help migrants adapt and thrive in their new homes, boosting skills development opportunities as part of these programs, investments in reintegration assistance. So if people return home, really providing targeted support to ensure that they can apply their skills when they return. So those are a few different goals that these pilot projects might try and serve. So to provide a little bit of context on what Europe is doing right now in this area. So we've heard about national initiatives, but the EU is also coordinating a couple of initiatives that I'll speak on briefly as well. So all the way back in 2017, the European Commission announced that it would embark on a series of legal migration pilot projects with several countries in Africa. So the key motive at the time was really to try and curb irregular migration. So if you look back at the proposal, there's quite a lot of language about helping to provide legal alternatives to irregular migration. But in practice, as we've seen these pilot projects being launched, we've seen a real range of different projects that have come to the fore. And I should also say that this sort of initial framing has slightly fallen away. And I think there's a lot more nuance about skills development and the benefits of mobility more broadly that's now being pursued through these different projects. So just to give you a couple of examples of these types of pilot projects, there was one that recruited IT professionals from Nigeria to Lithuania for temporary work and training. This was the Digital Explorers project. There's the Palem project, which provided training and employment opportunities in Belgium and Morocco for young IT professionals based in Morocco. We saw a project based in France that was matching recent graduates in Egypt, Morocco, and Tunisia with internships in different sectors. And then we've also seen the Match project, which is recruiting workers from Senegal and Nigeria to work in Belgium, Italy, and the Netherlands in different sectors. So things like ICT, pharmaceuticals, and electronics. So as you can see, there's quite a range of pathways and sectors and countries of origin being targeted by these projects. They have all currently really focused more on the STEM sectors, and particularly ICT. And there's a big emphasis on high-skilled roles here. And of course, most of the partner countries have ended up being in North Africa as well, which I think in part really reflects their long-standing cooperation with Europe and their experienced institutions in this area. And all of these projects to date have been quite small scale. So of these pilot projects, we're really probably talking about hundreds of people moving rather than thousands. So that's just one point to flag as well. The second initiative that Europe has really been working on is the talent partnerships, and I'll come back to this right at the end. But to quickly reflect on some lessons from these pilot projects, when done well, pilot projects can really allow you to test these new approaches. So if you were to look at some of the projects that have been launched in the last few years at the EU level, you know, one of these projects, for example, has tested the global skills partnership idea, where they're offering training to a large group of people and only some of them will move. So that's one example where you're really testing different ideas around maximizing the development benefits of these projects. But a lesson here really is that if you're going to really commit to experimenting and trying out different approaches, you need to build enough time and flexibility into these projects to allow you to really test things out and adapt projects as needed. So that's one perhaps sort of flip side to this lesson. Another lesson is that pilot projects can test demand for migration in certain sectors and from certain countries to try and meet labor market needs in both countries. But in order for that to happen, there needs to be a strategy to engage the private sector and keep them engaged throughout this project, and also to make sure that government actors remain on board. So you really need to engage everyone from the outset and really explain the benefits of participation as well. There also needs to be a really clear strategy for scaling up the project if it works. You know, all too often, you know, the scheme is quite finite, but there's not necessarily a clear vision of how this might fit into existing pathways or build on existing pathways, and how this might be funded as well. And then I think as a final lesson here is that it can help create a recruitment pipeline, both by testing the premise and working with partners in countries of origin to help identify promising candidates, and helping identify some of these fixes that are needed to common barriers to recruitment. But I think a sort of broader philosophical question here is, you know, how do you balance this targeted approach with more systemic reforms that can make it easier to immigrate more broadly? And I would argue that you ultimately kind of need to do both. There's an opportunity to experiment here, but there's also the clear need to address these broader barriers that can prevent people from moving across a variety of different contexts as well. So I'll finish by just talking a little bit about the talent partnerships. The details are still being ironed out by the European Commission, but this really follows on from the pilot projects launched 4 years ago. One thing to reflect on here is that these partnerships would bring together these targeted mobility schemes with broader investments in capacity building in third countries, which is a really promising development and could really help break down some of the silos in this area. It's also being framed less around irregular migration and much more around talent, you know, how to attract and retain talent and address, you know, labour market needs in European countries. So that's another sort of important distinction. There's also a broader geographic scope. So while they're still open in theory to Africa, there's also, you know, opportunities to pursue schemes in the Balkans and Eastern Europe as well. And there's a lot of flexibility about how these projects are being designed. But I think the next step will really be seeing if the initial interest from member states really translates into concrete commitments, and that's how these talent partnerships take shape and how they build on this wealth of experience in this area already. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, all four of you, for introductory remarks and for opening, like I said, opening the topic. And I think we can turn to questions. We do have some questions in Slido. And as I warned you, I do have some questions on my own. So I would start with you, Tesseltier, if you allow me. I think this is a question on you. What other policies or instruments at EU level should be adopted to strengthen legal pathways for middle and low qualified workers? We keep hearing about the policies aimed at highly qualified experts, but then the labor markets in the European Union do need also lower skilled and unskilled migrants, or workers, should I say. So what is your opinion? What is your take on it?
So this topic is typically the topic that I call the struggle for skills. So we've had talk of the battle for brains, but we have now moved into the struggle for skills. And practically skilled people are indeed in high demand. I think that's a given. The migration policies that member states themselves develop are often aimed at temporary migration out of fear that if these jobs disappear or whatever happens, that they cannot return people and don't have other jobs for them because they are not that high skilled and presumably not that easily moved from one job to another. I'm saying presumably because I'm not sure if that's right. It calls for a broad approach. We've already heard the whole of government approach with regard to migration policy, but I think it goes further. For instance, housing policies become very important when you're talking about people who have less money to spend on expat kind of housing. How is that provided for? Social security, health care, insurances, etc. We've heard from these projects, a lot of the landing that you facilitate for highly skilled is also something that should be facilitated for the practical skilled. But then employers have less budgets because it's already often in sectors that where the margins are small. So it would probably call a larger scale approach to cover the costs that might be attached to this. But I'm really interested to hear from the experience on the ground if that would be one of the dilemmas, or that is one quite easily overcome. I think these are some of the issues that come with this struggle. But broadening up the policy scope, looking at housing, looking at what companies require practical skilled people, because in the past, of course, we've seen migrants come for practical skilled work, like in the mines, and then the mines closed, and then we didn't know what to do with them. So we should not make that mistake again. So if it's a business sector that's on the road to aggressive innovations that might not need these workers in 5 years' time, I would say speed up innovation instead of recruiting the workers from a more long-term perspective.
That's interesting. Do any of you want to comment on that notion? Okay, so I turn to other questions. Maybe you will come up with some comment later. Another one is, I think, to you, Emir. You mentioned that there must be a surplus of talents or workers in the country of origin in order for you to include them into your project. How do you assess it? How do you practically ensure that you are not taking, and so the country of origin is not suffering, if I understood it correctly, what you mentioned?
Yes, of course. I mentioned it in my presentation, there is a strong cooperation between the partners, between the employment agencies in Bosnia-Herzegovina with the GIZ and BAA in Germany. There is every year a statistic of unemployment nurses that we received from the agency of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And to give you some numbers, in 2013, as the project starts in Bosnia and Herzegovina, we had about 7,000 unemployed nurses in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is for Bosnia and Herzegovina a huge number, because we have about 2.5-3 million people who live in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And this number, this 7,000 unemployed nurses, is not decreasing. It's pretty the same. 8 years later, we have now about 6,800 unemployed nurses. That's why the project still exists. That's why the project exists also in the Philippines, where we have also those kind of problems, and also in Tunisia. Mm-hmm. I hope I...
Yes, thank you. You know your field well. Marina, very practical question on you. Can you imagine that your project would be working also for non-English speaking countries? Because it sounds very English language based for now. And I understand that it's a certain phase of the project. But can you imagine that it would be adjusted so that it would work also for countries like Slovakia, for example, that is not an English speaking country?
Absolutely. So one thing that I didn't mention, and I was hoping it would come up in questions, is that we actually are working on a European Commission project with IOM to open displaced talent mobility pathways into Portugal, Belgium, and Ireland. So Ireland is quite a natural extension, and it really is with a focus on the IT sector and the IT demand in Ireland. But Belgium is very much looking at what we're doing in terms of the nursing healthcare pilots in the UK for Portugal. It is across the board in terms of occupation. So, of course, in those countries, we're looking at specifically the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium, and in Portugal there may be a working language in English, but of course for integration purposes Portuguese must be mastered, or at least there must be a basic command from our candidate. So we are starting to make those inroads to other countries in Europe. And just to the question around what we need from a European perspective, with the reform of the blue card, there were announcements around some concessions or considerations around displaced people. Having a look at what that might mean for Europe is going to be really important and exciting. But part of the pilot project, and to the point about pilots done well, one of the things that we really have to focus on is how to integrate language support from the outset and upon initial arrival into the country, to make sure that candidates have at least a basic functional command of the language, if not a full proficiency. So we know from the talent catalogue that we have a lot of candidates who are French-speaking and German-speaking, so we can definitely sort through that way. You saw Fadi in the video. He's fluent in French, which is fantastic for his work in Accenture because he's put on all the European accounts. But it's absolutely an intention. The other thing that we're looking at is expanding our source countries. So the reason we're in Lebanon and Jordan is because we don't want to get too big too quick. We really want to go through that phase of refine and grow. But growth is not only to other destination countries, it's other source countries. So the targets there are sort of Turkey is quite an obvious one, but then also Colombia and Kenya, as well as Ghana. So that fosters different sort of language capabilities that can be sort of shared, and candidates can have options for other countries based on what their language strengths are.
Another very practical question on you. How do you assess the step at which various governments are involved to obtain visas or other permissions? Is it smooth, or any particular obstacles regularly occur? Obviously, you do need states at least to issue residence permit or protection. My follow-up question would be, what is the practice? Is it usually, I think you mentioned that it's usually residence permit, not protection granted by the states. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So it's a very loaded question. Thank you very much for whoever asked that. But it is essential. So there are effectively five pillars that we look to when we look at destination countries. So the first is, does a pathway exist, i.e. is there skilled migration into that country? We look at that and see what needs to be changed, amended or tweaked for the purposes of displaced talent mobility. So we like to work with what already exists. The second is political will. So TBB really is apolitical. This is not a divisive issue. It's not a, you know, are you thinking with hearts and minds? Are you thinking commercially? Are you thinking humanitarily? Whatever it is, TBB solution can sort of cater to any agenda. And we are purposely really apolitical. So in terms of going into a new country, we need to understand the politics. And just to diffuse any sort of political agenda against this program, because it really is, we position it as the win-win-win. And in every country that we've been in, we've had to look at different sort of political tactics, but it's an essential part of building a program. The third pillar is bureaucratic will. So it's one thing for politicians to say, oh, yes, we're going to do this and we're going to issue visas. You need to be working with policymakers and decision makers who are flexible and agile and responsive to actually work with us to overcome the barriers that are in the grey area, like in reading between the lines, so that we can actually develop a permanent program. The fourth pillar is a demand. So a skill shortage, employers wanting to employ talent, irrelevant from where they're from or what their background is. And the fifth one is social and community will. So we really harness this idea of community-led welcome and candidates arriving to the country and being integrated by their community. So like a peer-to-peer integration. So it's really important to understand all those obstacles. It is in an ideal world that they all exist up front. There has to be a lot of lobbying and advocacy and education around what we're doing, but we now have enough evidence to show the benefits of this for all the stakeholders from different angles, whether it's a conservative government like in the UK or Australia right now, or a government like in Canada, which has always been quite supportive of refugee and humanitarian initiatives. The point is it works across the whole spectrum. To the question around what visa we use, we absolutely strive to use a skilled visa. And the reason for this is that our program exists to be in addition to any humanitarian resettlement. So in making sure that this is a skilled visa pathway, where we make sure that there is no blurring of the lines about keeping the sanctity of the most vulnerable refugees versus, you know, saying, oh, well, this is just going to, these are effectively humanitarian applicants, but they can do things for our community. So that is one of the main reasons that we keep this as a skilled visa program. The second is a really pragmatic one in that employers want to hire employees, they don't necessarily want to sponsor refugees. And so from when you think about the private sector and employers being a key stakeholder in this, like it begins with an employer, you don't want to have a program where you're introducing them to a whole new refugee and protection stream of work when their mobility team is most used to doing skilled visas. So that's a really pragmatic thing. And finally, from a candidate perspective, they are, you know, updating their skills, they're learning the language, they're getting tested on their technical skills, doing assignments. Like we've had a butcher who had to do videos of slaughtering animals, and we've had, welders who've like shown videos of what they do. We had a interview for a cook where he actually did like a cooking class about like how he makes his food. And so employers are really sort of open to understanding the skill and all that sort of stuff. And then if you turn around and say, okay, well, you've been accepted on skill, but now tell us why you're vulnerable and why you meet the humanitarian requirements, is really quite confusing from an identity perspective for candidates. So for all those reasons, from the advocacy, from being able to engage partners and stakeholders to giving the candidates a sense of real direction and purpose and pathway, we go for skilled visa options. Very often they are temporary, that are linked to a sponsor, then they go to permanent and eventually citizenship. In the UK, for example, that is a 6-year journey. Australia, that's a 4-year journey. In Canada, they go straight to permanent residence, although processing time is a little bit longer. So again, that is part of the informed decision-making process. So once candidates get an offer, we say, okay, you've been offered this job as a software engineer, you'll be coming on a skilled worker visa, which is temporary for 5, etc. And so that is part of their decision-making as to whether they want to accept that as a pathway. So thank you.
Knowing many refugees, I can even imagine that many of them personally would prefer this pathway before even being granted humanitarian protection. So I can imagine that it must work. And the final question to you, Kate, how do you see the talent partnership policies? Is it the way forward for the European Union? It was encouraging to hear that some of the pilot projects actually get to turn into programs, like you mentioned, the talent partnership. So is that way forward for the EU?
I think, again, it's about this question of how these schemes fit in with broader policy priorities. So the talent partnerships were launched and were sort of part of the new pact on migration and asylum. So alongside the pledge to launch these talent partnerships with different countries of origin and really sort of try and combine these targeted mobility schemes with broader investments in capacity building. There are also plans to reform different aspects of European migration policy. So we've heard about the Blue Card Directive being reformed, and that might, you know, be approved next month. There are other plans in this area. You know, for example, one idea that's being floated around is creating a talent pool where this would combine, you know, applications from candidates, put them in a sort of pool, a little bit like what Canada has with its Express Entry program, which would allow, you know, employers who are interested in recruiting a skilled worker to kind of go to one place and then, you know, look for candidates there. So I think that's a good example of how talent partnerships are likely to remain quite small in number, but they offer an opportunity to experiment and to build those working relationships and to test demand. But equally as important, or perhaps even more importantly, you know, there are efforts to try and address different aspects of, you know, the immigration process that make it easier for employers to understand how this works, make it easier for, you know, immigrants and employers to access these processes and streamline them a bit. And I think that those will benefit potentially more people ultimately. So I think it's the combination of the two, you know, having this targeted approach that allows you to innovate and test new approaches, but also pursuing systemic reforms as well that can break down some of the obstacles that prevent people from using these channels.
Thank you very much, Tesseltier, Marina, Kate, and Emir. Thank you very much for your time, for your interventions. Unfortunately, our time is up, so we have to end this very interesting discussion and very interesting panel. I hope we do remain in touch, and I would encourage our participants as well, if you do have any questions, any further comments or anything, it's very easy to connect you to our dear participants and to our presenters as well. So we are open to provide that connection. So thank you very much, and all the best to your future work. Thanks.
This panel discussion was part of the EMN Educational Seminar on Migration entitled Migration in a Multilateral World. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.